what they will do. Your best friend, that's what they will do. That's what they will do.
That's reggae legend Peter Tosh with That's What They Will Do. It's from his album, Wanted, Dread, and Alive, issued as two different versions, one in 1981 for Jamaica and the United States by EMI America, and the other for Europe by the Rolling Stones Records. And then it was reissued in 2002 by Capitol Records, with bonus tracks on that. This is Lead Stories. I'm Hugh Treece Lead. And as you know, in a series of programs leading up to the presidential primaries in South Carolina, here at Lead Stories, we've been explaining the pivotal role the South, and South Carolina in particular, would play in the political fortunes of the presidential candidates. Of course, you know that the Democratic primary on February the 27th yielded a stunning victory for Hillary Clinton. And there's a reason. And so today, we'll talk about her triumph in South Carolina as an object lesson in political slavery. Now, as you know, South Carolina, one of the former Confederate states, and to the minds of many historians, the very seat of the slave trade in the United States, South Carolina was for Hillary Clinton a necessary win. And South Carolina had been set up to be a necessary win because, as I had said before in these various programs that we've been doing, the South is actually the seat of black political power. The vast majority of black voters will be in the South, despite the fact that people are impressed with the concentration of African Americans in what are now politely called urban areas. The fact is the South still remains the home to the vast majority of African Americans. And it stands to reason that the larger share of voters will be in the South. It was not at all surprising, and we talked about the fact that this was going to be the critical and pivotal point. I told you that, and I wasn't kidding. And as you can see, I was dead on. The South Carolina vote was to begin a momentum toward her inevitable election. As I say the word inevitable, because, you know, it was planned, it has been planned, and it has been in the works for quite some time. She missed out when Barack Obama was elected in 2008 and then in 2012. But in 2008, she fully expected, as did the Democratic Party as a whole, fully expected a Hillary Rodham Clinton victory. she had by then, of course, extracted from the corrupt party a gift, a concession, if you will. She was able, as a at least positioning herself as a loyal wife, to walk out of the White House as the First Lady and into the Senate to begin her ascendancy to, for her, the throne, because of course she considers herself something of a queen. But it was facilitated by a corrupt process and a corrupt party. And so she was given that gift of the U.S. Senate. You would never think that when the way she talks, but that is in fact what happened. Hillary Clinton was given the gift. A path was cleared for her to get into the U.S. Senate as her first elected office. And from there, of course, naturally, it provided a trampoline into the White House, which was her ultimate destination. And this is in part to, quote, make history, unquote, and in part to reward herself on the basis of her entitlement to that office. But of course, this wasn't done all by Hillary Clinton alone and the machine, the well-moneyed machine that helped to fund this quest. This was done with the absolute cooperation and subjugation and submission of black political leaders. And this is where we see that history, in fact, has taught us quite a lesson. I refer to a book published in 1933 by Carter G. Woodson. And it is fitting to end Black History Month with the man dubbed to be the father of Black history, Carter G. Woodson. And this book, one of several that he had authored, is titled The Miseducation of the Negro. It was published in 1933. And here he says, and I just extract a small quote, but it's of devastating application, given the times in which we live. The problem of holding the Negro down, therefore, is easily solved, he writes. When you control a man's thinking, you do not have to worry about his actions. You do not have to tell him not to stand here or to go yonder. He will find his proper place and will stay in it. You do not need to send him to the back door. He will cut one for his special benefit. He will go without being told. His education makes it necessary. That's profound. And that summarizes where we are. We are in this time, we are repeating slavery, the tenets of slavery. This time, we of course put it in the political context. The slavery, the enslavement by the Democratic Party of African Americans, and their self-enslavement to a party for no particular reason other than their education. And the education, as Amos Wilson reminds us, is for self-annihilation. Hillary Clinton is making great speeches, and she is celebrated. And we understand why. We understand the dynamics. All this week, I'll be talking about this just to get you to understand, or to persuade you to understand, that this election is extremely important for white supremacist America. It has nothing to do with the Democrats and the Republicans fighting, and this is an exciting presidential race. No, no, no. As I've said repeatedly, this election is to serve as the last-ditch effort before the inevitability of that seismic shift, demographic shift, that the U.S. Census Bureau had told us about, that will be completed, that will have been complete by the year 2032, when the United States will no longer be a predominantly white nation. It will be a majority non-white nation. And we have gone through some of the permutations, and we are seeing now in this current race, this presidential contest, that the new generation, this seismic shift is occurring even within the political power structure. They're not saying it, but it's very clear. Practically none of the current candidates would have been considered to belong in the realm of power just a blink of an eye ago, historically speaking. They would have been categorized across the board, almost without exception, they would have been categorized as defective by racial standards. They're not white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, as the dictates of America had commanded for the power and the authority to do anything at a particular level. And that applies to the front runners as well. Donald Trump, only a blink of an eye ago, would not have been white enough in America to be considered white. Hillary Clinton, who just basically is a byproduct of working class life and being kind here. Absolutely, and don't even talk about Bill Clinton. Never, ever would have had the audacity to even hope to rise to the ranks that they have politically and with such power and with such wealth. They would have been excluded because they were not white enough, as defined not just by social custom and cultural custom, but by law. By law, these were not white people. So we don't need to discuss whether Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz and John Kasich, these people, this generation of candidates, though white, I'm technically including Marco Rubio and others, but I'll get to them in a minute. The people we accept as white today, the candidates running, would never, ever have belonged. In the case of Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, I refer you to Noel Ignatieff's book, How the Irish Became White, although Hillary Clinton says that her ancestry is Welsh and some admixture of other European ancestry. But definitely, Bill Clinton, no way would he have been considered a white person in America by law. We don't need to discuss Ben Carson. We don't need to discuss any of the others. This is what is significant, and it's being overlooked, but it's a very important thing, because this is the shift that is occurring even within white America. White America is putting some elastic in the notion and definition of whiteness itself. And it has to do it. It has to let these kinds of people in because numerically there is a problem. Whiteness, as they defined it originally, is just about dead. It's dead. The purity of whiteness has been compromised by the inbreeding with other groups that heretofore would never have ever have been considered to qualify for membership in white America. So let's understand that as a huge and significant point about the nature of this election. And the reason these candidates have come forward, these white candidates have come forward and have had a shot, either now or in their previous political life, at power and authority, the reason that they had gotten membership, and by the way, it was conditional, it still is conditional, because they're not real pure. Purity was important, but pure whiteness had to deal with the reality of the inevitability of its death. It just couldn't sustain that purity. So it let people in and gave them the privileges of whiteness. And whether on the Republican side or the Democrat side, we have candidates today who are now, oddly enough, looking at others as the others, because they understand themselves to belong in the circles of whiteness in America. They have scrubbed themselves, some of them, because they understand what Carter G. Woodson said. You have to make yourself anew. That is, you unmake yourself in service of what the system expects of you. Barack Obama went through that. Ben Carson went through that. Ted Cruz went through that. Marco Rubio went through that. John Kasich went through that. Bernie Sanders went through that. To deracinate. Because everybody understands the implicit law. Whiteness is the first qualification. And if you don't qualify genetically, you have to at least qualify psychologically. You make yourself into something that will be tolerated and certainly expected by the system. So, because you understand that no matter how things turn, you initially have to convey to the system that you will be a loyal acolyte of it. You're not going there to really tear anything apart. You're there substantially to carry through its standing orders. See? So that's why when people start talking about Barack Obama as a black president, blah, 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 I say to them, you know, I appreciate the fact that you are one-dimensional in your view. You don't understand what this is about. Read Carter G. Woodson's book, The Miseducation of the Negro. So we come fast forward into modern times. And progress, now, progress is a degree to which these very people who should be permanently encoded with a historical memory, it is the first thing they have to give up. And they understand it. And this explains why, when South Carolina should have been the absolute destruction not just of Hillary Clinton personally, but of the whole idea of Hillary Clinton, the whole idea of the Democratic Party as deeply rooted in the slavocracy. When this memory should kick in, and it should guide their decisions, it should instruct them as to what the correct position should be in order to honor that historical memory. What do? They part ways with it. They pretend they don't remember it. Worse, they pretend it doesn't exist anymore. And if it does exist, they have denatured it. It's just a memory. It's like going down memory lane. It's like, it's the past. And we have had so much progress. We have come so far that these things, even to the people, the very people for whom this should be an indelible stamp, they are the ones systematically uprooting it, destroying it, making sure that you and I and others do not recall it. And their actions now become consistent with the expectations of the system that created them for the specific purpose of being ambassadors. They are like control levers. So as Carter G. Woodson wrote, the holding the Negro down is easily solved. It is not a big problem. So that when you control people's minds, you control their actions. And this is what we saw. This is why Hillary Clinton won. You control people's minds. We have not seen anything new. This is not a spectacularly new thing. And this is why she, her victory is so incredible. No, this is a repeat. And if you doubt me, I want you to listen to this tape. This is a woman of great dignity and pride, a woman of incredible courage named Fannie Lou Hamer. And I introduce this piece to you. I'm sure some of you might have heard this before. But here is Fannie Lou Hamer speaking in 1964 at the Democratic Convention. Why is she speaking at the Democratic Convention? Who is Fannie Lou Hamer? She actually is a sharecropper. She and her husband and her children, the whole family, had just been steps away, essentially, from actual total enslavement. They call them sharecroppers, but it was a retooled form of enslavement. And she decided to challenge that. She, not just herself, but she was a lightning rod. And the brilliance of Fannie Lou Hamer and the courage of Fannie Lou Hamer have to do with the fact that she understood that what was responsible for her condition of oppression, which was shared with thousands and thousands of African Americans all through the South, was that the system had its agents. The system was clear about the power equation that should never change. It was to be in charge for all time. And it would use other blacks to enslave other blacks. You see, she got that message loud and clear. Joseph Raw, who was the attorney representing a group that Fannie Lou Hamer was instrumental in organizing. She was instrumental in organizing a movement within the Democratic Party against the Democratic Party called the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And she was confronting the Democratic Party, the one that said they're so democratic, for the right to participate in its convention. And here's what her attorney said as he was explaining to the credentials committee. He said that he was representing the Freedom Democratic Party and was calling a series of witnesses. And here's the reason, he said. Your Honor, I must respectfully disagree. It is the very terror that these people are living through that is the reason that Negroes aren't voting. And they're kept out of the Democratic Party by the terror of the regular party. He used the word terror, not once, but twice. And what I want the Credentials Committee to hear is the terror which the regular party uses on the people of Mississippi, which is what Reverend King was explaining, which is what Aaron Henry was explaining, and which is what the next witness will explain, Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer. So this is a party, this is a terrorist party. And he said it to the Democratic Party, and it was not refuted. They didn't argue with that. This is 1964. Here in 2016, we have some Negroes who don't recall this. And if they do recall it, they refuse to honor it. They desecrate it. Let's hear from Fannie Lou Hamer what she and others suffered in the pursuit of getting the vote. You know, the same thing that these worms went around and said to Hillary Clinton, oh, we could get this easy piece of cake. Here's Fannie Lou Hamer recounting what was invested to get that far.
Chairman, and to the Credentials Committee, my name is Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, and I live at 626 East Lafayette Street, Roseville, Mississippi, Sunflower County, the home of Senator James O. Eastland and Senator Stennis. It was the 31st of August in 1962 that 18 of us traveled 26 miles to the county courthouse in Indianola to try to register to become first-class citizens. We was met in Indianola by policemen, highway patrolmen, and they only allowed two of us in to take the literacy test at the time. After we had taken this test and started back to Roseville, we was held up by the city police and the state highway patrolmen and carried back to Indianola, where the bus driver was charged that day with driving a bus the wrong color. After we paid the fine among us, we continued on to Roseville, and Reverend Jeff Sonny carried me 4 miles in the rural area where I had worked as a timekeeper and sharecropper for 18 years. I was met there by my children. They told me the plantation owner was angry because I had gone down, tried to register. After they told me, my husband came and said the plantation owner was raising Cain because I had tried to register. And before he quit talking, the plantation owner came and said, Fannie Lou, do you know, did Pap tell you what I said? And I said, yes, sir. He said, well, I mean that, said, if you don't go down and withdraw your registration, you will have to leave. Said, then if you go down and withdraw, said, you still might have to go because we are not ready for that in Mississippi. And I addressed him and told him, said, I didn't try to register for you. I tried to register for myself. I had to leave that same night. On the 10th of September 1962, 16 bullets were fired into the home of Mr. and Mrs. Robert Tucker for me. That same night, two girls were shot in Roosevelt, Mississippi. Also, Mr. Joe McDonald's house was shot in. And June the 9th, 1963, I had attended a voter registration workshop, was returning back to Mississippi. 10 of us was traveling by the Continental Trailway bus. When we got to Winona, Mississippi, which is Montgomery County, 4 of the people got off to use the washroom, and 2 of the people to use the restaurant. 2 of the people wanted to use the washroom. The 4 people that had gone in to use the restaurant was ordered out. During this time, I was on the bus. But when I looked through the window and saw they had rushed out, I got off of the bus to see what had happened. And one of the ladies said it was a state highway patrolman and a chief of police ordered us out. I got back on the bus, and one of the persons had used the washroom got back on the bus too. As soon as I was seated on the bus, I saw when they began to get the 5 people in a highway patrolman's car. I stepped off of the bus to see what was happening, and somebody screamed from the car that the fire workers was in and said, "Get that one there." And when I went to get in the car, when the man told me I was under arrest, he kicked me. I was carried to the county jail and put in the booking room. They left some of the people in the booking room and began to place us in cells. I was placed in a cell with a young woman called Miss Yvester Simpson. After I was placed in the cell, I began to hear sounds of licks and screams. I could hear the sounds of licks and horrible screams. And I could hear somebody say, "Can you say yes, sir, nigger? Can you say yes, sir?" And they would say other horrible names. She would say, "Yes, I can say yes, sir." So I said, she said, "I don't know you well enough." They beat her I don't know how long. And after a while, she began to pray and ask God to have mercy on those people. And it wasn't too long before 3 white men came to my cell. One of these men was a state highway patrolman, and he asked me where I was from. And I told him Roosevelt. He said, "We're going to check this." And they left my cell, and it wasn't too long before they came back. He said, "You are from Roosevelt, all right," and he used the curse word. And he said, "We're going to make you wish you was dead." I was carried out of that cell into another cell where they had 2 Negro prisoners. The state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro to take the blackjack. The first Negro prisoner ordered me, by orders from the state highway patrolman, for me to lay down on a bunk bed on my face. And I laid on my face. The first Negro began to beat. And I was beat by the first Negro until he was exhausted. I was holding my hands behind me at that time on my left side because I suffered from polio when I was 6 years old. After the first Negro had beat until he was exhausted, the state highway patrolman ordered the second Negro to take the blackjack. The second Negro began to beat, and I began to work my feet. And the state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro had beat to sit on my feet, to keep me from working my feet. I began to scream, and one white man got up and began to beat me in my head and tell me to hush. One white man, my dress had worked up high. He walked over and pulled my dress down, and he pulled my dress back up. I was in jail when Medgar Evers was murdered. All of this is on account of we want to register to become first-class citizens. And if the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hook because our lives be threatened daily because we want to live as decent human beings in America? Thank you.
Well, you can tell the agony here in her voice, but you can tell the horror. And the lawyer for the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party was right. This was a terrorist party. And she was addressing terrorism orchestrated by this party and using as agents of terror her own people against her and others and across the South. And this should be sacred. This fact, this historical fact, this experience should be so sacred that it should be considered a crime to desecrate this by being so casual and say, well, hey, you know, we're going for Hillary. All of that suffering, all of that humiliation, death threats, physical assaults, beatings, lynchings, all of these things that happened in the South did not happen so that a bunch of crazy people calling themselves leaders should just blindly decide that Hillary Clinton deserves the benefit of that. And without a demand for anything. She doesn't have to do anything except say, you know, the basic throwaway lines, Black Lives Matter, and she recognizes there's, quote, income inequality, all the other pathological things. But without extracting any kind of concession, without having the consciousness that they should report to people what she is, what they demanded of her, and what she has committed herself to doing. She does not have to do anything. The system is taking care of business. And that's why I say to the community at large, this is also a historic moment, because we ought to make up our minds to put an end to this. We ought to absolutely defend the historical record, defend the memory of a Fannie Lou Hamer and all of these thousands and tens of thousands of people who, driven by just a quest for justice, tolerated and endured through a whole bunch of indignities, lynchings, torture, tyranny, terror, including at the hands of the Democratic Party. You see, so when you are disconnected from this history, or if you have no respect for it, and you think it is progress, that you have arrived at a point where you can make an individual decision that belongs to you, that you're not an agent of this charge, you're not a person who is supposed to be a link in this chain of reaction to a system, an unjust system. But you think this is about you having arrived and you at a point where you sit on a great committee in Congress, or you get to be called, something by with a title, or you get to hobnob with the hobnobbables, and you get to go to the White House, and you get to mix and mingle with the big lobbyists, and you probably are earning the most money that you have ever earned as a salary in your life. You begin to take personal possession of these things, and you begin to think that this is about you and your personal accomplishments. And that makes you a perfect tool. That makes you completely susceptible to corruption by this party, which is corrupt, totally corrupt. The whole process is corrupt. And so, along with the Democratic Party, we have to put its agents on notice. We do understand and we do honor the struggle. We do value the incredible sacrifices that were made, just simply for the right to be. And this is not anybody's personal possession. I mean, people are so disconnected from this essential message, this essential mission. They've taken these things as if this is their personal thing. I mean, you can't but understand how sad it is that women, mothers of people killed by police, wives of people killed by police, would actually use the deaths of their sons and their husbands and their children as a political endorsement of somebody who doesn't give a damn whether you live or don't live. That is how disembodied we have become. And for what reason? The absolute stupid reason. She was there. What does that do? So is there an indictment to show for it? Is there a conviction to show for it? No. But there is a plank for criminal justice reform, so the state could be far more efficient about putting your sons and daughters in jail. There is that wonderful three strikes you're out kind of thing that her husband passed. There is no evidence at all that this woman is in any way really interested in structurally altering anything for your benefit. And you are not thinking twice about the fact that tens of thousands of people who have no connection to you nonetheless recognized the atrocities that were occurring and put themselves in the street in service of justice for you and your departed ones, your murdered ones. But it is Hillary. These are mothers. They stand there and the woman is the greatest thing. I'm standing with Hillary as if the death, the brutal death of your loved one is now also part of a kind of political a plaything. You disgraced that in service of entitlement. That's what Carter G. Woodson was talking about. We are in sad shape on that level. And this election year should once again drive home the point that we got to do something fast. Because there is no safety zone. And all parties and individuals seem to agree that the least protected people are the choicest people to go after, the best folks to annihilate. And in this nefarious undertaking, they have full cooperation from their so-called leaders. It took 24 years, quarter of a century, after Fannie Lou Hamer's speech to the Democratic Party, for Jesse Jackson, a son of South Carolina, to come forward and present himself as a candidate worthy of the investment of this hard-won vote. And guess what? In the blink of an eye, he turned all of that over to the Democratic Party, sold out completely, and has been selling out ever since. It has become his cottage industry. The leadership, the so-called leadership, that should be real clear that it is about the welfare of the aggregate good for all people. They have a vested interest in going with this Democratic Party because they're wedded to it and it has taken their souls. They have no souls anymore. They cannot be trusted. They cannot be, certainly cannot be entrusted with your future, your life, your interests. They prove time and again that they are totally compromisable. And there's nothing they won't do. I mean, when mothers are offering the memories of their children in service of furthering a person's personal quest for the White House, and a horrible person at that, you know, we have really sunk to very, very, very dangerous levels here. We've got to do something and do it fast. So this is the lesson of South Carolina. This is what I was telling you about. And South Carolina and its performance, because all of the black ambassadors were sent out, you know, like the same thing Fannie Lou Hamer was talking about. The people who were sent to do violence to her were black people, black men, beat her up within an inch of her life. They sent out the black ambassadors to do violence to their own communities, to betray them and sell them out. I tell you, this is the year of reckoning. Get busy about designing something different outside of this ridiculous, useless, and predatory party. Get out of it and get it out of you. Think instead and concentrate instead on putting together systems that have to do with promoting the aggregate good and welfare of the people. That will work. It doesn't have to be perfect, but it certainly has to be independent. And we have to start fast, because at every single level that this power structure has authority over our lives in. They have total control. There's no real resistance anywhere. Certainly, there's no effective resistance. And that is what we have to do. We've got to devise systems that we control and we design and that we operate in our interests. We also have to root out, disavow, publicly separate ourselves from these traitors, call them out, castigate them, bring them to the public's attention. Let the people know we are not going with this person. This person is basically, not healthy representation for us. This person is cooperating with a system that means to do us in. We are publicly canceling that person's contract. And that's where we want to start. I thank you so much for listening today. I wish that you would stay on for Global Research News Hour comes up next. Reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. I would love hearing from you. And of course, as always, it's a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Dress up in your clothes and punch you in your nose. Dress up in your shoes and still carry false news. And I know that's what they will do. That's what they...